This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can now watch our TV show on Free Speech TV every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. FSTV is on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. On October 7th, 2001, the United States began a bombing campaign followed by a ground war called Operation Enduring Freedom in direct response to the September 11th attacks. That war continues today, 15 years later, with prospects for peace more elusive than ever and no end in sight. The Afghanistan war is the longest war the U.S. has ever waged, but you wouldn't know it judging from scant media coverage and barely any mentions during the presidential debates. Today, the Taliban are stronger than ever before since 2001 and are battling the Afghan National Army over the key northern city of Kunduz. The Islamic State has made its sinister appearance in Afghanistan with a devastating bombing in July in the capital Kabul that killed 80 people and injured hundreds. Warlords remain strong and secure with political power and the backing of the U.S., and U.S. troops remain indefinitely. The biggest losers are, as always, the Afghan people. My guest is Kathy Kelly. She's the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. She travels to Afghanistan frequently and works closely with the Afghan peace volunteers. Welcome to the program, Kathy.
Thank you, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. How are you reflecting on this 15th anniversary? I have been very depressed, actually, that I've been involved in this issue as well, and thinking about the fact that this war has gone on now 15 years, and it doesn't seem like very much has changed. If anything, things even seem worse. What are your thoughts today?
Well, it seems as though international concern about Afghanistan has been fading, and it's sort of almost unthinkable to me that the international community is telling those among the 2.6 million people who have left Afghanistan that it's perfectly safe for them to go back. It doesn't seem like any of the factors that you would look at when you try to see a secure place really indicates safety. In fact, when the United States embassy people land in Kabul, they don't drive the 15-minute drive to their embassy. They go by helicopter. And, you know, we're looking at the country with the highest infant mortality rate in the world, according to the CIA World Factbook. Amnesty International's report in May about internally displaced people in Afghanistan gave just a chilling, terrible report about 1.2 million people displaced internally with very, very high rates of unemployment. We're looking at a country wherein so much money has been spent on weaponry and spent on surveillance and spent on special operations to do night raids, to imprison people, to displace more people. And yet what people have suffered, I think, is barely really even noticed.
I mean, some of these statistics that you're citing were very similar to what Afghanistan was experiencing in 2001 when the war began. Maternal mortality, infant mortality, unemployment, the refugees, you know, they had huge refugee populations in the neighboring countries. The difference was the Taliban were in power. U.S.-backed warlords were on the defensive. The U.S. sort of flipped that balance of power, and not very much else, sadly, over 15 years really has improved. There were some moments where, you know, girls' schools were built. Many of them were burnt down or torn down or closed down. And yet, Kathy, hasn't the U.S. spent more money in Afghanistan? I saw the stunning statistic, more money spent in Afghanistan than on 16 European nations after World War II as part of the Marshall Plan. We've poured all this money into Afghanistan. Where's it gone?
I think something like $111 billion, according to a recent report by John Sopko. You know, he's the head of the Special Inspector General Office for Afghan Reconstruction. And I mean, one very telling example of the corruption has to do with healthcare delivery in Afghanistan. In July, John Sopko had written to the head of USAID, and it was a kind of a blistering letter asking how it can be that of 614 healthcare delivery, sorry, 641 healthcare delivery places that were claimed to be functioning when this SIGAR group, the Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction, began to examine the coordinates. They found that six of the so-called healthcare facilities were actually located in Pakistan. Six were in Tajikistan. One was in the middle of the Mediterranean Sea. So then they really started examining every single coordinate, and 80% of them were of questionable locations. And of that number, in 189 of the coordinates that were submitted, indicating that there's a healthcare facility there, there wasn't any building to be found for 400 feet in any direction of the coordinate given. So were these ghost hospitals? And are there ghost schools and ghost enrollments in police forces? Well, Afghanistan is listed as tied with Somalia and North Korea to be the most corrupt country in the world, according to Transparency International, 2 years ago. And even so, the sense of many people, I think, in European countries is that the Afghan refugees ought not be welcomed as people with reason to flee, that they should be sent back. And that's into a country where there's already close to 40% unemployment. So there seems to be a huge lack of compassion and empathy, as you've mentioned. But I think we should also recognize that major United States companies, Northrop Grumman, Lockheed, Boeing, have made huge amounts of money by selling, by peddling, by experimenting with weapon systems in Afghanistan ever since that invasion in 2003.
Now, the other thing, Kathy, that the other sort of faction that has benefited and is doing really well are Afghanistan's old warlords. The U.S. Backed and the Afghan government, which is, of course, sponsored by the U.S. government, made a huge deal in recent weeks of the so-called peace deal that it signed with one of Afghanistan's most notorious warlords, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. Hekmatyar was once known as the Butcher of Kabul. He was also designated a terrorist by the U.S. State Department. Now John Kerry basically has signed off on the Afghan government's peace deal with Gulbuddin Hekmatyar that would forgive him of all past crimes. How is Hekmatyar seen by the Afghan people, you know, the Afghan peace volunteers that you work with? What opinion do they have of Gulbuddin Hekmatyar?
Well, they have, ever since I've known them, recognized that there are multiple warlords who maintain great power, who have a great amount of weaponry, who can sometimes more or less tell the government which direction to go in or how resources are going to be used. And so they've never felt that they're facing a secure future wherein adults are looking after their best interests. I think that it's remarkable to me that the young people I know have themselves shown so much compassion and empathy for people who are more desperate than they are. And many of the people I know, young people, don't even have enough money for bus fare to come to a meeting often, to be with the other youngsters at a place they have called the Border Free Center. Many of them have experienced hunger and displacement and bereavement in their own lives. And yet, you know, as they look at another cold winter coming, as they know that many people are saying, my children won't survive the cold winter, they once again are organizing to enable widows, women with no income, to at least get enough of a living wage to feed their children through making big, heavy blankets, which they will then distribute free of charge to some of the neediest families that they've met. And they do this respectfully. They do it with a sense of personalism that simply amazes me and edifies me. You know, I went with them to the emergency surgical center for victims of war in Kabul. I have O negative blood, so that place is always kind of glad to see me so I can donate some blood. And while we were there, we asked, was there anybody who had survived the bombing of the Kunduz hospital and been brought for surgery to their hospital in Kabul that we could talk with? And I've been thinking about him so much. The young man that we met, his name was Khalid Ahmed. He was a pharmacist, a young pharmacist, and he had managed to survive. I think he felt survivor's guilt in a way, because 42 people had been killed and 12 of them were staff members, 3 were doctors. And I recently read the United States' own military investigation of that bombing. And what they said was that it was a disproportionate response to a non-existent threat. And you know, Sonali, I think that describes quite a number of United States wars, a disproportionate response to a non-existent threat. And then they said that something was pretty unusual in as much as there were at least 50 squirters that had fled from the building while it was under attack. And in military parlance, a squirter is somebody that runs away from an attack. And if you're, for instance, operating an unmanned aerial vehicle, United States drone, then part of your job is to track that squirter and kill the person. So I have to hope that Khaled Ahmed never knows that in military parlance, he was regarded as a squirter as he ran from that hospital and tried to get beyond the hospital gate to save his life. And he took in his spine part of a bullet, and this had almost killed him. But fortunately, family members were able to rescue him.
The United States had, and under Obama, had announced a drawing down of troops in the past. And I should say also NATO, of course. Afghanistan is that country that gave NATO its new lease on life early in the war when it took over from the United Nations. NATO finally had a war that it could get behind after the Cold War was over. But U.S. and NATO troops, and particularly U.S. troops, were supposed to start withdrawing. President Obama called a halt to that because the Islamic State, our new bogeyman, our new enemy that seems to be everywhere all at once, has reared its head in Afghanistan. And I mentioned the horrific attack in July that killed 80 people in Kabul, the capital. So a very brazen attack. Is this basically going to be the next great justification to continue this war endlessly? I mean, in 5 years, are you and I going to be talking about the 20th anniversary of the longest war, the war without end?
Well, I think we certainly bear a big responsibility to insist that United States leadership, maybe not necessarily within elected leadership, but in the universities, in the faith-based groups, amongst the community leaders, begin to ask what alternatives are there to trying to resolve the crisis about ISIS militarily. I think the United States has repeatedly helped enable recruitment for ISIS by the supposition that the only toolkit, the only way to respond is through aerial attacks, through being able to round people up and possibly torture them, possibly imprison them. Is there some other way to better understand why, in the first place, would anyone ever feel so much revenge, so much grievance, so much desire to strike back, that they would join with the groups that are part of ISIS? And I think, if even just a tiny fraction, for instance, of what has happened to people in Iraq had happened to people in the United States, there would be enormous desire for revenge and retaliation. Again, I look at the Afghan peace volunteers and I'm simply stunned by their desire to abolish wars and to try to live nonviolently. They are certainly people who would have reason for grievance in this war.
What about Afghan women, Kathy? Of course, we can't just simply separate women from the entire population, but a lot of the justification that the U.S. gave back in 2001 was that in addition to exacting revenge for 9/11, they didn't use those terms, but basically that's what it was, that it would be freeing Afghan women from this, a group rightfully characterized as one of the most sort of fundamentalist misogynist groups that we had seen at the time. And Laura Bush suddenly became a feminist. And today, it doesn't seem like Afghan women are much better off. There was a horrific story last year, last December, of this woman, Farkunda, who was essentially lynched in public by a mob of men with Afghan police watching and falsely accused of burning a Quran. Are Afghan women any better off than they were in 2001?
I would say that within Kabul, there might be, and they often speak of Kabul, but there might be some better circumstances for opportunities for education. But countrywide, the literacy rate amongst women is 24.2%. The infant mortality rate being the highest in the world means that of every 1,000 live births, there are 112 deaths. This certainly indicates that women are not getting adequate health care. The possibility to improve education for women and girls is dim, and I think especially about those youngsters who are working out on the streets. There are so many young people who are the sole source of income for their family. And again, my young friends in the Afghan Peace Volunteers have helped me meet some of those youngsters because they run a school for street kids. And it's so important to try to get the girls away from the trafficking going on within the busy streets, because as they grow older, they could get caught up in human trafficking. So again, the need for compassion, the need for dedication, that this is the worst possible time for a fading of international interest or concern for people in Afghanistan.
So Kathy, at this point, tell us a little bit about your work. You've talked about the Afghan Peace Volunteers during our conversation. I understand you were last in Afghanistan in May. How best can Americans express solidarity with Afghans, short of, you know, pushing for an end to the U.S. war in Afghanistan, and pushing for some kind of peace and justice rather than, you know, leaving the country in the hands of war criminals? What else can they do to directly work with Afghan people?
Mm-hmm. Well, it may seem like a strange word to use, but I like to keep focusing on the word reparations. I think the United States has been the source of and the cause of tremendous displacement and suffering and bereavement in Afghanistan, and we should pay reparations. Now, the cost of the war during the surge for 1 week was, I'm saying the surge of U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan, would amount to about $2 billion per week. And to restore the agricultural infrastructure in Afghanistan would be very, very costly. It would mean trying to replenish the flocks and clean out the irrigation systems and replant the orchards. And some years back, there hasn't been anything very current, but some years back, Alfred McCoy, a very fine researcher who kind of does this sort of number crunching, estimated that it would cost about $36 billion to do those tasks related to restoring the agricultural infrastructure. And I remember thinking, well, $36 billion is a lot, but that would be about 17 weeks of the war. And so, yes, I know the United States is facing enormous struggles domestically and trying to deal with climate change within our own country and the ways in which our infrastructure is in great need of repair. But I believe the United States could take the money away from the major military contractors and tell them that they are no longer going to be dwelling on the privileges of corporate welfare, and begin to redirect that money to rebuilding and to paying reparations to the countries that we've made war on. And if we were to do that, then I think that some of the feelings of desired revenge would be lessened, and other people in other parts of the world would say, well, the United States tries to act fairly and justly internationally. So this is something I think people could clamor for, and we should be in touch with elected officials and also in our grassroots organizing, continue to say we're going to look squarely in the face of what's been done to people in Afghanistan who meant no harm to us, and we're going to try to make a better difference.
Kathy, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Is there a website for Voices for Creative Nonviolence that you'd like to give out?
Sure. Ours is vcnv.org, the acronym for Voices for Creative Nonviolence. But please also visit ourjourneytosmile.com. That's the website for the Afghan Peace Volunteers and their Border Free Center. And, especially if you're in a down mood or feeling a bit of despair, really you'll find an antidote in the videos and the photo essays and the very hopeful and dedicated and altruistic depictions of their lives together in Kabul.
Ourjourneytosmile.org.
.com.
Thank you, Kathy, so much for all the work that you do. I might have to visit that site tonight to try to feel a little bit better about this war. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest is Kathy Kelly. She's the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. She has traveled to Afghanistan many times and worked closely with the Afghan peace volunteers. We've been talking about the 15th anniversary of the Afghanistan war, which was October 7th. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/RUWithSonali.